I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Lords Podcast with Will Rowe.
Well, welcome along to the latest edition of the Lords Podcast. This month, we look back on the cricketing summer, look forward to the Ashes Down Under, catch up with Stephen Fry as we launch our new Lords animations here at the MCC. As well as all this, Angus Fraser reflects on Middlesex's season. And in the history section of the podcast, we head down memory lane with Mike Gatting and Michael Palin. There are plenty to get through, and it's my great pleasure to welcome my co-host this month, who's perched up in the JP Morgan Media Centre with me. It's the editor of the Cricketer magazine, Mr. Andrew Miller. How are you?
Hello, Will. I'm very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Good to be at Lords.
Lovely to be. Always lovely to be at Lords. Even when the sun's setting, the season's over, and the pitch has been scarified, I believe is what they call it.
Something like that.
It's suddenly looking a bit different to the height of summer, that's for sure.
It looks like it hasn't seen much rain and it's had a lot of sun on it, doesn't it? Doesn't look very English out there.
No, we're a bit like Port Elizabeth or somewhere, but very pleasant.
Fantastic. And I'd just like to ask, how are things going at the Cricketer?
Very well, thank you. Put the latest issue to bed yesterday, so perfect time of the month. You know, just sit back, kick my feet up on the desk, and pontificate for a wee bit. That's what we got lined up. So no, it's all good. Great fun. I've been in the role for about 19-20 months now. So yeah, it's been an eye opener and really enjoying the challenge.
And previous to that, of course, you were the editor at Cricinfo at UK.
That's right. Effectively, I was, you know, the England correspondent for Cricinfo and basically in charge of all things English when it goes into what is essentially a global site. So, you know, I was cornering off the English market. Fantastic job as well, you know, absolute plum job, and did that for about 10 years. And then got the opportunity to edit a magazine that's been in existence since 1921. You know, I just thought, wow, opportunities like that don't come along every day. I give it a go, and it's really enjoyed switching from online to off, which is kind of counterintuitive in this day and age, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's something I wanted to ask you about. Were you nervous to sort of go into print when everything seems to be pushing towards online at the moment? Everything's going online. It's the multimedia age that we live in, especially with cricket, Twitter, all these kind of things.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a big decision to make, but I figured that personally, I was approached in many ways because of my online experience. You know, that ability to bring everything I've learned and everything I know about cricket journalism is about the online world. So then to have that knowledge and take it back into a print magazine that basically needs to modernise, needs to get with the times in the best possible sense. I'm really enjoying that, marrying up the virtues. The thing I enjoy most is the chance of really sort of mull over an issue. You know, Cricinfo was all about instant analysis of things that have happened. Bang, you write it. You know, you might write it at 2 o'clock in the morning because it's just happened. But you know, there are no sort of deadlines. At the Cricketer, you can just stop for a bit, not forever, but for a bit, and just really think and craft it nicely, and you know, make sure it's designed to the nth degree. And you know, I think that's kind of the secret for all print publications. It has to sort of sing from the page. If people are going to pay for what is editorial in this day and age, it's got to have value added, I suppose, is what you call it. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do, and it's a major challenge, but loving it. And I've got both sides of the bread buttered, I guess.
How much cricket do you get to watch as an editor?
Less than I did as a correspondent, that's for sure. I mean, it's, you know, I got out to probably about 7 or 8 days of the Ashes this summer. So one whole test and a couple of individual days. So not as much as I used to. But again, I'm having done sort of exhaustive coverage of Test cricket. It's kind of nice to have that change at least in the short term, and then maybe come back a few years time and hit the road again.
And you've got a collaboration with MCC here in the academy. There's the Good Gear Guide. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, the Good Gear Guide has been in existence for many moons now. But last year we did this, as you say, this collaboration with MCC. Basically, got the opportunity to pillage the shop, which was just awesome. We did it on a nice bleak morning in January, just straight after Christmas, and you know, go and pillage the Lord's shop. We went up and down the aisles, picked out the best bats on display. Took them into the nets, all 47 of them, and smashed the balls around all day long. It was brilliant. And so we turned that into a supplement for the March issue. And then in this issue, just coming up ahead of Christmas, we're doing a junior buyer's guide. So we're going to have an eight-page supplement within the magazine. Basically, if you've got a nephew or a son who needs or a daughter who needs their first bat, buy the magazine and we'll tell you all about the best ones.
Brilliant. Is there anyone, any famous cricketer in that? Is it?
To be honest, I don't know for certain yet because we haven't quite nailed down. We literally, as I say, went to bed with the last issue, and we're going to tuck into the next one in the coming months. So we'll probably bring out a surprise somewhere and see who we speak to.
Keep the listeners on tenterhooks. And right, let's get into the cricket then. What's the season been like for you? What's been your standout moment of the 2013 cricket summer?
Well, I think it's got to be that final day at Trent Bridge. I mean, that was just extraordinary, especially at that time of the summer, wasn't it? When we were wondering, will this Ashes live up to all the hype, etc.? And it's always the case, isn't it? Every time you get to the first day of an Ashes series, it's always that, is it going to be as big as it is? And that Test match, just the nerves and the tension on display on both sides. I mean, you know, England were not at the races on that first morning. I mean, I remember the ground being so quiet that day. It was weird. And then on that final day, them just having to knuckle down and Jimmy drag him over the line, and it was brilliant. And it really did, you know, some people were a bit disappointed with how the rest of the series went. You know, how you can be disappointed with a 3-0 England win, I don't know. But certainly at that stage of the summer, you thought, wow, we're in for another 2005. And you know, you couldn't have asked for more from a first game of an Ashes series.
How do you react to, as you just touched on there, some people were disappointed, and there's been a few journalists sort of criticising the manner in which England have played, and also the manner in which they've dealt with journalists and the press and the media. You're the other side, of course.
Yeah, I think they're two different issues, to be honest. I think if England want to have a bad rap with the press, that's an issue for their media managers and their overall attitude. I divorce that from their play on the field, to be honest. If, you know, I don't see Stuart Broad being grumpy in an interview as the same thing as Stuart Broad standing his ground in a Test match. As it happens, I thought that was brilliant in only insofar as I don't know anyone else who could have got away with it. The brazenness of standing your ground when you hit the cover off it, and basically staring down the umpire and daring him not to give you out. I mean, you know, if it was a poker match, you'd think, wow, that was the best bluff I've ever seen. So, you know, you can hum and haw about the spirit of the game all you like, but ultimately it was yet another example of someone's will to win. And frankly, I suppose that again comes down to this dichotomy that England face at the moment. People want them to be entertaining, but at the same time, they also want them to win. And when you won 3-0 and nearly won 4-0 in a five-match Ashes series, I think it's splitting hairs a wee bit to start complaining about the manner in which you've done it, as long as you've done it. That's ultimately what pays the bills, as far as England are concerned.
And we've had that great Ashes summer, and it's starting all over again. I mean, the squads have been announced. We've got this back-to-back series. They go straight out to Australia now. The squads were announced in the Lord's Long Room. The replica Ashes urn was there, and the Waterford Crystal Ashes trophy was on show. A bit of a mouthful, that.
Absolutely.
What are your initial thoughts on the Test squad going out to Australia?
Yeah, I got no complaints with it whatsoever. A couple of obvious names stand out. Gary Balance surprised me. I think, you know, it's harsh on people like Nick Compton to miss out, especially Michael Carberry. If you look at the stats that he's had, I think George LaBelle put it well on Crick Info, that Michael Carberry's got one second division 102 seasons and Compton's got six plus two Test centuries in two seasons. So, you know, if you're going purely on Red Bull merits, it's hard to see how Carberry gets in and Compton gets out. But
Do you think the time has come for Compton? I mean, it's come and gone.
I think it has, sadly. I mean, you know, Jeff Miller's eternal cry is the door's never shut, but I think the door has been firmly slammed shut in poor Nick Compton's face, and I don't know, I feel very sorry for him. He's not done a lot wrong, but at the same time, I found watching him, you know, you just wondered, does he have another gear? You do look at some players who can, Alistair Cook, for instance, who, you know, bats in a pretty dour manner usually, but then suddenly you let him loose in a 20 over situation in a 50 over game, and suddenly he's smashing 150 strike rate. So, you know, I don't think Compton has that ability to turn up his tempo in the same way, and especially I think Nasser made the point on Sky that if you're opening with Alistair Cook in a situation where England are probably going to want to build partnerships and just bed down with Jonathan Trott coming in at three as well, you want to have someone who's a little bit different, because those three could actually end up grinding the machine to a halt if you want them batting to their merits. So a little bit of difference, because you've got KP and Bell to be all flighty further down the order. I mean, a bit of balance is what they're looking for, I guess.
Well, nice pun there, yeah.
Well, a bit of balance. Good Lord, I ought to do this for a living. So, yeah, and he could smash it. So there we go. Maybe we're going to answer my own query on that one.
Lovely. And in the bowling stakes?
I was surprised that Rankin and Tremlett was chosen. I got the impression from the way that the selection had gone all summer, with Tremlett being talked about in dispatches but never quite used, that Rankin, you know, similar height but younger and you know, pretty effective in the one dayers, looked like he was going to be that bloke to come off the bench and be the scary enormous bloke to come in at Perth and do what Tremlett did last time round. But no, England's reckon that that, you know, going for that extra height is the way forward. I do feel sorry for Graham Onions. That's the biggest sort of loss from this. And again, Jeff Miller saying that we can just throw him on a plane and get him out there, but it's not quite the same thing as, you know, I remember Gus of this parish back in 94-5 when he missed out on the Ashes tour. I mean, it was a scandalously bad decision, and it got rectified. He did come into the tour later on, but you just wonder, why do you not pick a quality performer like that in the first instance? I think, you know, he could do with a man to back up Jimmy more than anything else.
It begs the question, how much more Graham Onions could have done? I mean, at the time of recording this, 69 wickets at just over 18 apiece in the County Championship.
143 in his last two seasons. I mean, it's just nuts. I mean,
the question for Jeff Miller is, if that's not enough wickets to get you in the squad, how many wickets do you have to take?
I know, and it's not as if he's not a proven performer. I mean, he's performed in the 2009 Ashes. He was a star performer with the bat, as it happens, in the 2010 series in South Africa. So and you know, he got very unlucky with a career-threatening injury. So to come back from all of that and still return those figures, yeah, I don't understand what they've not seen in him. They know that he can do it at test level, and they've seen for sure that he can do it at domestic level. So very unlucky. But, you know, the guys who've been picked, Finn hasn't been the best of form lately. Tremlett, we know, has always got injury concerns. Jimmy, you never know, he can break down, and, well, Broad lasted, tested a bit on the last campaign. So, you know, accidents do happen. You never know, he will get a call-up at some stage. You suspect it might happen sooner rather than later.
Lovely. Well, I'd like to talk about the laws of cricket now.
Goody.
Not always the sexiest of subjects, but without doubt, very crucial to the game. MCC, who own the laws of cricket, have produced 5 short animated films to help explain some of the most widely searched cricketing laws online. What is a wide ball? How many types of no ball are there? And just what is leg before wicket? With the help of narrator Stephen Fry, the viewer joins young cricketer Tommy, who's a computerised avatar, as we see the laws come to life on a blackboard. Here's Fry, who umpires from time to time, talking through the LBW law.
You develop a sort of ability to replay in your head. You look, which is why a lot of umpires look straight back down again and then slowly raise the finger, because they're going through all the things that it pitched in line with leg, or it pitched in line there, or if it pitched inside, it pitched out, pitched outside, off. So it didn't pitch in line with the stumps, but he wasn't really playing a shot anyway, and it definitely would have gone on to have hit the top of middle. And sometimes they're just plumb. sometimes just, you know, plumb Yorker on the foot or something, and you think, oh, that's so easy.
What was it about this project that made you want to get involved in it?
Well, I think cricket is a complex game, and if you haven't grown up playing it at school, it's very difficult for all the nuances of it to come, you know, to be available to you. And you hear these extraordinary things which you and I, when we watch it or listen to a commentary, they're so natural and normal, you know, like, you know, just flick down his leg side and maybe hit his hip thigh pad or, you know, or he, that was a bump ball. And you think, well, but he caught it. Why didn't he know it was a bump ball? He drove it into the ground and it looked like a catch. And they go, oh, God, there's that. And then there's the weather and the tea and the declarations and all these things to be taken into consideration. But the most important thing with the test match is just one rule. You have to get 20 wickets or you can't win a match.
Stephen Fry there discussing our new laws, animations, projects and umpiring. These short films will be launched in October, so this month, on lords.org. And they're also available in Hindi and Urdu. The former Pakistan batsman Ramis Raja provides the Urdu translations. You can check them out on the Lords TV channel, which is on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube/Lords Cricket Ground and tell us what you think. Tweet us, @homeofcricket is the handle. It's that simple. Andrew, 42 laws. How's your knowledge?
Well, funnily enough, I did an umpiring course just over the road at the Danubius in the beginning of the season. Now, I passed, so presumably they're better than rubbish, but I need to swat up. The one I know almost off by heart these days is Law 42.3 because of the invariable ball tampering fiascos that crop up from time to time. I was in the thick of things in 2006 at the Oval when all that kicked off. So, this disfiguration of the ball is one that crops up endlessly in my line of work. And, that pretty much... it's less a law, it's more a sort of treatise these days. It's so many sub-clauses and rehashes and basically just bin the lot and start again, to be honest. But...
And for someone that's coming afresh to cricket, I mean, how confusing is this game?
Well,
we've followed it for so long now.
Well, yes. I mean, put it this way. Last night, I think in common with pretty much everyone who likes sports in this country, I became an America's Cup fan for one race only. And so switched on halfway through just before the race began. But, you know, knowing that it was 8-all, having been 8-1, they got top 2 points for having ball bearings and they got a jibe and they got a... all the rest, and it's like, okay, they've got to get from one end to the other, but I simply don't understand any of the goings on in between whiles. And you know, that's only a race. I mean, this is a 5-day test match we're talking. So yeah, to come into that blind, if you're not versed in the whole thing, I mean, God, I don't know where to begin. I mean, for years I've always meant to try and get my head around baseball, but again, I simply don't know what's going on out there because I've not given myself the time and opportunity to immerse myself in how it works. So, yeah, it sounds like a great project. I look forward to seeing how it pans out. And, yeah, as I say, I'll brush up on a few and maybe have a refresher course for my umpiring next summer.
Well, brilliant. I mean, the first 5 videos are almost there and I've had a little look at them and they look fantastic. You've got Tommy, who is our little avatar, talking you through it, and then Stephen Fry there, he's narrating it. So, no, they're fantastic. And hopefully you'll get kids coming online, as they do on their tablets and iPads, etc., having a little look and, you know, learning about the laws of cricket because, yeah, it is confusing. The OBW law, that's a tricky one.
Yeah, there were so many elements of that I got wrong in my course as well. I think it was a multiple choice options on whether things were out or not, and it's surprising how many I got wrong. It's just, you criticise umpires for getting them wrong all the time, but there's a lot to think about.
Middlesex County Cricket Club at Lords since 1877.
A slightly frustrating season. That was the main assessment from Angus Fraser when I asked him earlier how he felt Middlesex had fared this year. However, with 6 victories in the county championship, it was certainly an improvement on last year, and all the signs are there that the Lords-based team will be pushing for silverware again next season. Both captain Chris Rogers and Fraser admitted that ultimately they had been let down by their batting. Well, after the marquee signing of bowler James Harris at the beginning of this season, I asked Fraser if he had anyone lined up for 2014, particularly in the batting department.
We're yet to find out, or it's yet to be announced, but I think, I say, the signing for us may well be Owen Morgan if he loses his central contract.
Yeah.
And that's what we're still waiting on. We don't know, that hasn't been released yet, but We haven't got the funding to be going out there and getting any big name players this winter. So what we'll be working on is improving the cricketers that we've got and building on what we've got in that way, on what we've achieved this year in that way.
And I guess that sort of brings us on to my last question, which is, you mentioned it earlier, clearly the middle order has been a source of problems for you this year. If Morgan was to lose his contract, his central contract, then he would bolster that naturally. Is it just a case of working hard in the nets over the winter, or just playing more cricket, or just maybe a bit more belief in that middle order?
I think it's a combination of all those things, to be honest. I don't think... I mean, anybody who's seen Milan, Denley, Dexter play... and again, if we're talking about the middle order, I'm pulling those names out because they'll all accept that they want to do more. We'll know what fine players they can be and how destructive they can be and how they can take the game away from an opponent in a 2 or 3 hour session. And again, it's a bit of a quandary that, I mean, Denley and Milan have had excellent white ball seasons.
I was going to say that Milan seemed superb in the YB40 competition.
So it's not a lack of talent, but it's down to us as a club to sort of, and them as players primarily, to get the best out of themselves.
Gus Fraser there on Middlesex and that middle order conundrum. It's sort of an interesting thing that he touched on there, kind of wishing one of his players to lose out on an England central contract, Owen Morgan.
I know, it's funny to talk of it as a signing when, you know, he's been a Middlesex player for as long as I can recall. So, yeah, it is a funny world. And it just goes to show how rarely these counties see their star players when they do get international call-ups, which also, you know, talking about a disappointing summer, I mean, they can't have imagined that Chris Rogers was going to get nabbed for the Ashes. So, you know, to lose your captain and opener in that manner is, you know, unfortunate. But, you know, they look on course to finish, well, fourth probably by the time this goes out. So,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, it's not a bad season, but I certainly had them down as one of the contenders this summer. That's for sure. They look like a side who've just pulled it together a wee bit in recent seasons, in much in the way that Surrey haven't yet. So it's onwards and upwards. It's always the way, even with a misanthrope like Gus and George.
we also talked about Sam Robson, Gus and I. He's a great player, and he's got this kind of the heritage question now coming into his mind. You know, is he Australian or is he English? He's been selected for the England Lions, I believe. He's going out this winter. But, you know, if Australia decide, well, actually, we'll knock on his door, see what he thinks. England opening partnership looks, we guess, Root and Cook. They're probably going to be around for a while based on the way the England selection has been over the last few years under Flower. So.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. I mean, with Robson, I mean, the Aussies have actually changed their own rules to court him. It's the unofficially known as the Robson rule. You can read all about it in the Cricketer next month, actually. And it's got this... because when you have qualified as a Australian-born player to play in county cricket, you can't then go back to play in the Sheffield Shield. It seems very... You cut your nose off to spite your face sort of reaction. And they've decided that's a bit stupid because obviously anyone who's any good who has dual nationality is going to want to come and play in county cricket because there's more money over here than and also more money if you want to get into the England setup as well. And Robson, to judge by what he's said, you know, he's been here 6 years. He says he's very settled in London. He's giving off all the noises as if to say, you know what, Australia, yeah, back off. I'm a pawn now. So we'll see. But as you say, if this Root Cook opening partnership carries on, and you know, as you say, they're both young. There's plenty of reason to believe they will remain in a partnership for ages. Who knows? Until he's picked by England, anything's possible. The Lions doesn't change a thing. So I dare say England might just throw him in for a one-day international at some stage, just to sort of tie-dye him, and then he's England forevermore.
How cynical! and who's your county?
Well, funnily enough, I grew up in Dorset, so I didn't really follow a county as such. I was sort of caught between Somerset and Hampshire, but I end up more into the personality. So Gus was one of my heroes. Gucci for Essex. Both of them at Worcestershire in those days. Graham Hick as well. Those are the sort of names I scour the Times scorecards every morning and look out for the key people. Toughers as well. So, you know, that was kind of how I followed my cricket, very much on scorecard and personality basis rather than county basis.
And do you still do that in the county championship?
To a certain extent, although, you know, it is difficult these days with, as you were saying, with fewer of the real star names available anymore. It's tough to, you know, it is a problem that I don't think the administrators address properly, how to ensure that you know, and we've seen with Durham's season, there are some great stories to be had in county cricket and all the rest, but without the hook of a real interesting personality who will drive it into the papers, it's a real tough sell. So, you know, I fear for the propagation of the game in that respect. I think it needs to help itself a bit more, and that really ultimately comes down to the ECB helping the counties with more availability, I think.
History and cricket with the Lords podcast.
In 1987, Mike Gatting got his name up on the Lords Honours Board when he struck a century in the MCC versus a rest of the world 11 in a test match to celebrate the bicentenary of the club. I caught up with Gatting, who becomes MCC president this October, in the committee dining room and started off by asking him what he remembered from that match.
If ever there was a stage set for a magnificent game of cricket, that was it. Some wonderful players on both sides. But I felt I was the luckiest person because I had a bloke called Malcolm Marshall I'd never had on my side before, and I had a huge amount of respect for him. To have him on my side, although I had Richard Hadley too, I had a huge amount of respect for. In fact, all the guys that you played with, you know, you had Imran on the other side and Courtney Walsh and Abdul Kader. You know, we had people like Ravi Shastri and John Embry there, Imran Khan as well. So, you know, you just had a huge amount of talent on show that day. Yavid, me and Dad, Greenwich, Haynes, Gavaska. I mean, just go through that wonderful, wonderful bunch of names, and you just sort of think, you know, what would happen in this game of cricket with that sort of side out there? Would they cancel each other out or not? But the sun was out, the wicket was good, and we managed to win the toss and have a bat. It again was one of those sort of lovely times where we got off to a reasonable good start, but I managed to get in early, and I think I might have got dropped actually at a mid-on at one point. I think I was hitting Abdul somewhere and mistimed it, but it was put down, I think, by me and Dad actually, I'm not sure, but I think I got dropped at some stage. But after that, it was, the guys were running in on a very, very hot day on a very good wicket. And the fast outfield, you know, there was a great crowd out there. So it was just, everything was there for a wonderful game of cricket.
And it was a real stellar cast of players, as you mentioned. I mean, you were facing Imran Khan, Courtney Walsh, Kapil Dev. You still got to that 100 mark. What was that? What was it like as you inched closer to a century and you thought, get my name up on that honours board?
I don't think I was thinking about that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think Abdul probably bowled quite a few overs and Roger Harper as well on their side. But yeah, we had our fair share of the guys coming at us. But you know, there are guys we'd all faced in county cricket, and it was quite a good wicket, I have to say. It was very flat and it was hot, you know. And it, I think everybody was out there and they were really trying to entertain the crowd. And that's all we were trying to do. You won't get it in a better arena against the players. It wasn't probably quite like playing for your own country, but as I say, the attack itself that we were facing was an extraordinary attack.
Mike Gatting there recalling his 179 against the rest of the world. Do you remember that game?
I certainly do. It was almost certainly my first proper memory of cricket. I would have been 9 at the time. I do actually have two memories. Funnily enough, they both revolve around Gat around that time. My first real season of being into cricket was 1989. That Ashes, for some god-awful reason, that really got me hooked. But my first memory, I think, must have been the 86-7 tour, watching Daddles the duck walk off the screen when Cathy got out for a duck. I just remember thinking that was brilliant, but I never saw it again because obviously it was the only thing that Australia did. So I wondered for years what happened to Daddles the duck. And then the second thing was Gatt walking off the field straight after being bowled, declaring his innings shut after 455 for 5 declared. Bowled by Courtney Walsh and picks up his bat and walks off. I remember thinking, as a 9-year-old, is he sulking or something? What's going on here?
What about the spirit of the game? It's funny you mentioned that. I'd forgotten about that duck. They had that duck in South Africa as well. I was a kid watching cricket in South Africa, and they might have been playing Australia actually, so it might have been networked TV station. But yeah, the little duck, and he put his bat underneath.
That's right.
Off it goes.
Off it goes.
You'd just be praying as a kid that they got ducks. You just saw this little duck walk across the screen.
Hours of entertainment. It never caught on over here, though.
The Lords Podcast. Memories of the home of cricket.
Well, it's the bicentenary of Lords Cricket Ground, as it is here, next year in 2014. In its third guise, as it were. So Lords was the first ground, was down at Dorset Square, just near Baker Street. And then there was also the second ground was known as North Bank. I've been told by our librarian in the MCC library. That's where Listen Grove dissects Regent's Canal. So anyone that knows the St. John's Wood area quite well, you're kind of coming northwards. And anyway, so it's the 200th year of the ground, and there's going to be another MCC versus the rest of the world in 2014. It's going to be a one-dayer. So
bring it on.
Looking forward to that one.
Certainly am, yeah. They're great events. I think it's going to be a women's game as well, so it's going to be hopefully all the great names will be out. I mean, you know, the chances of ever being able to whistle up 22 of the greatest players in the world for 5 or 6 days, I think it was a rest day as well, wasn't there? You won't get that in this day and age, but to get them all for a day, I think that's certainly feasible, and I imagine it'll be a pretty spectacular lineup. So bring it on.
Absolutely. Earlier this month, Michael Palin popped into the MCC library to have a chat with cricket broadcaster and cricket historian David Raven Allen. The former Monty Python star and Raven Allen had a chat over a cup of tea and a slice of cake. Here they are discussing how Palin first fell in love with the game as a young boy in Sheffield.
In school, of course, he supported a Sheffield football team and Yorkshire cricket. And there was the Yorkshire League, there were many good games I saw up at Hallam. We had some Frickley Colliery and people like a lot of sort of miners teams would come along, and you saw some good games. I got extremely excited.
Yorkshire League cricket or Lancashire League cricket,
yes.
Either of them. I mean, it's a pretty high standard, isn't it? You know,
a very high standard, yeah. Mm. And always, I mean, there was a certain amount of professionalism, but there was a great deal of sort of just sheer enjoyment of the game. That's where I sort of.
And you fantasised when you were playing in the back garden, did you?
Well, yes.
You were Len Hutton or something?
I was, yes. I used to play out whole test matches, usually test matches, and I think it was county games. I must have had an awful lot of time on my hands, and I was, you know, couldn't be the bowler because there was not much room, but I could be the batsman, so I'd make a lot of play going round by the dustbins and down. Walking down to where there was a big drain pipe, and that would be where the stumps were.
Right.
And I just loved all the detail of, you know, adjusting them, adjust their belts, adjust the pads, look around.
Oh, you really went to all that?
Oh, yeah, I loved all that. I think that's sort of early indications of my sort of a kind of a way of looking at the world like an actor does or a writer does. You know, you notice little things that other people might miss. So it was the detail and how they sort of got down to it. And I would sometimes just, on a whim, it would be Hutton or somebody, and be out first ball, just suddenly decide, you know, it'd be a lot of preparation, a lot of digging in, a lot of looking around, marking the crease, all that sort of thing.
You were really
everyone expecting a century. And there he is, nicks it, caught at first slip, you know, and he had to walk all the way back.
Michael Palin there, talking about reenacting test matches as a young boy in his back garden. Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah. All the time. Actually, I spent more time playing, how's that? You know, those little silver dice, the six-sided sort of tumbly dice thing, which invented entire great conundrums of that, because the fundamental flaw of that was it was just 1 to 6. So, of course, if you rolled a 6 and then another 6 and another 6, you get completely unrealistic scorecards. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with a situation where if you rolled a 6... you had to roll again, and then maybe it would be by the end of it, that's a dot ball. So it used to last for days. We used to do that at school all the time. A group of, I suppose we must have been the fairly geeky side of the school. It was less involving heroes. It was more involving sort of slightly pseudo political teams. I think, you know, Pol Pot caught Reagan, Bull Thatcher, that sort of thing.
Really?
end up some extraordinary scorecards based on current affairs. But anyway, you know, we all end up with doing random things when you're kids. So.
That's an interesting one. It's funny you mentioned that. Greg James, who was here, the Radio 1 DJ, who I think has had a run-in with Jeffrey Boycott.
Indeed.
He popped into Lords for the Australia test, and he told us that he used to put a shower mat down on his back garden on the wicket overnight. So he was like Mick Hunt. He would cover the wicket with his mum's shower curtain. Yeah. So I think there must be something in sort of young cricket fans growing up that you just recreate. I mean, maybe that's the beauty of cricket, is the length that the game takes to play as a kid with a lot of time on your hands and not a lot to do, let's be honest.
Well, I know that I ended up being a Fraser-esque seam bowler because I was effectively an only child. My brothers were 7 and 8 years older than me and away at boarding school. So the only place I could really play cricket in our house was down the alley with the apple tree next to me. So, you know, pick an apple and bowl it down the alley, and if it didn't hit the side of the wall, it was a good ball. So I spent hours raiding the apple store and destroying the crop. But it was,
did you have the slightly staggered run-up? Did you come in at a slight angle?
No, I had to be arrow straight because the path didn't go around a corner. So it was literally, my run-up is entirely designed to fit into a garden. And still is to this day.
Lovely. Well, Palin is clearly a big fan of cricket, and he's been a big fan of coming to Lords throughout the years. First came to the ground back in the 60s, and here he is continuing the conversation and talking about what he believes is a kind of quintessential cricket crowd.
It actually happened the other day. I had to go to a physio who had a practice on Wellington Road, and I came out, just the people were coming down for the start of the test match. It was like this huge sea of middle-aged men there, sort of thermoses and lunches coming towards me. You know, it was quite intimidating. I was the only one going up the hill. And I thought, this is a cricket crowd. This couldn't be a crowd at any other ground anywhere. These are cricketers.
Old ladies could feel threatened.
Yes, well, they could, yes. Yeah. They might be helped across the road against their wishes. Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of jackets and sort of ties.
Finally, what do you think a day at Lord's comprises?
I think it's a long day. And I think the two ways of doing Lords. One is to go there and socialise and have a nice meal and a bit to drink and doze off just when the vital moment's happening in the cricket. Or the other is to go and just watch every ball. And I'm sort of torn between the two. I'm quite a sociable guy, and I've met so many people here, including, you know, the great Keith Miller towards the end of his life. But I'm also, I do love the detail of the game. I think the audience ought to be giving it the same application as you expect of the people out there on the pitch.
Some lovely thoughts there from Michael Palin on coming to watch cricket at this great ground. We've already sort of talked about your first memory of Lords, which was the 87 Rest of the World match. What's it like coming to this ground as a journalist? And can you remember the first time you walked through either the Grace Gate or the North Gate?
I certainly can. The first time I came here was it's actually quite late on. It was 96 India Test was the first time I actually got to the ground. I'd been to a few tests down at the Oval before that. I went to my first ever test was 1990 at the Oval. So this was the first one I got to. It was Dickie Bird's final game. And he was, you know, he had tears in his eyes as he triggered Athers in the second over or something. So I actually ended up on telly patting him on the back as he left the field, I think. So that was a good moment. But it was it's amazing. Every time you come here, it always gives you a spring in the step. It always helps that little gradient down from the tube station as well. You can't help but sort of speed up because you're going down a slope. It's like the tractor beam is pulling me in, and it's fantastic. I generally come in from from the North Gate, but every now and again, obviously, for Lord's dinners and what have you, come through the Grace Gates, and that's a special treat.
Absolutely. And that lovely description there by Palin of the Lord's cricket crowd and the men with their blazers and their lunches. Do you get that in other cricket grounds or maybe other sports? I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is. I mean, obviously, you get it in certain sort of Henley situations, but I think there's more of an engagement, I feel, with cricket as the sport that's going on. It's obviously a great social occasion at Lord's with the Blazers, etc. But I also feel that, you know, when a lot of the time when you go to blazered events, it's more about going out back and hanging around the champagne tents. I sense there's much more engagement with what's going on out in the middle here in a cricket game. Largely, I suppose, because it lasts all day. Therefore, when you are watching, you're going to be really into it. It gives you an opportunity to, you know, you always sense that this crowd is attentive,
yeah,
and ready to react to whatever, whether it's an opposition 100 or a key moment in a game. There's always that hubbub going on, isn't there? That you never fail to appreciate it.
And the players deserve the attention, as
absolutely,
you said. You
yeah.
know, they're out there and putting on, well, a real performance.
Absolutely.
Well, as the sun is setting on this lovely September afternoon, I'd just like to ask what's in store for you now as we head into the winter.
Well, it's a good question. We've got another issue to put together. We've got it's a special captain's themed issue, this one. We've got a Michael Clarke interview, and obviously there was a great captain's dinner the other day with 22 legendary test captains all rolled up to take part in that. So I've spoken to several of them and going to pull that together in the next issue. And then it's the Ashes, potentially going to the Adelaide Test. Still TBC. Again, it's a difficult one in my position as an editor with sort of rolling deadline monthly. I can't just drop everything and dive off for the 2 months of an Ashes tour, much as I'd love to. But so I might sneak myself a 10-day trip to Adelaide and do some features on obviously what's going to be a very renovated ground by the time I get out there compared to the one I've been for the last two Ashes tests out there. And then it's into the deep midwinter, bit of Christmas, bit more Ashes. And then the Good Gear Guide in January. So it's it never stops. It's always rolling, and it's going to be a great winter, isn't it? I mean, you know, to get an Ashes series out of the way and have another one straight ahead. I mean, you know, some people call it overkill, but I can't help but be excited about it.
Absolutely. And can we just get any sneak preview into what that Clarke interview will say?
Well, it was a very very interesting scenario. I spoke to him. First of all, various top-ups involved, but the first and key moment I spoke to him was on the eve of the Old Trafford test.
Okay.
So obviously he was a man under serious pressure, 2-0 down in the series. You know, I think speaking to the media at that moment was probably the last thing on his mind. But then the following day, he came out, got 100, nearly got Australia back into the series. And you can't help but admire him. I mean, especially given that his back looks like it's going to keep him out of the India tour. He looks like he's been operating on one disc all summer, but he's still an incredible performer and I think an underrated captain. I've got a lot of time for him as a leader and a captain. I think he's in a very tough job and doing the best he can, but I don't think it's going to get any easier this winter. I think he might struggle to gel his team sufficiently to overcome, well, 3-0 deficit in the home summer. You don't go into a home series against teams beating you that heavily with anything other than a bit of foreboding, I think.
Absolutely. As you say, it's going to be a great winter of cricket for all us cricket fans to look forward to. And many thanks for coming on the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Certainly have. Yeah, it's a beautiful evening. Very, very nice, company. And yeah, excellent. Anytime.
Great stuff. Well, many thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next month with more cricketing stories from Lords. So remember to follow us on Twitter. We're at Home of Cricket. Be our friend on Facebook. And for all the latest news from Lords, just go to lords.org. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.